Hello and welcome to Criterion
Close Up.
I'm Mark Herney. We are here, episode 22. I'm here with Aaron West. Hello, Aaron.
Happy New Year, Mark. First episode of the year.
Yeah, happy 2016.
Yeah, it's going to be quite a year coming up, I think.
First full year of Criterion Close Up.
That's true. We had a shortened year, but no, it feels like a full year in a good way.
Yes.
I mean, we got out a lot of material.
A lot of work, a lot of prep, yeah, it was great. So,
and 22 episodes.
Yeah, very cool. Mm-hmm. So today we're going to be talking about A Room with a View. The opening music you heard is from the opening track over the credits of the film, so appropriate there.
Mm-hmm.
Director James Ivory, producer Ishmael Merchant, of course. So this is a Merchant Ivory production. So we'll look forward to that. But we do have a few housekeeping items, as we always do, to talk about. And we had a big announcement just recently.
Yeah, and in fact, we should mention, well, the big announcement is that we are now part of Criterion Cast. And we will put a link in to the announcement that they published on their page in the show notes. But also, this may be the first episode that people are hearing on the Criterion Cast feed. So to those of you who have never heard us before, I don't know how many there are, but hello, welcome. We like Criterions just like those guys, so you're in good company. But yeah, it's if those who have listened to our cast, it's no secret that we are big fans of Ryan and crew, and have been. I know you have been.
Oh yes, yeah, good friends, good fans, and we love the content they produce. You know, it's very, very varied. I mean, they have. They talk about Criterion films. They talk about Blu-rays. They do news. So, and they're also Masters of Cinema Cast is also part of the network. So there's a lot of really excited to be part of that great content.
And they actually don't restrict it to Criterions too, which I like. For instance, Scott did a review on Fireman's Ball from Arrow recently. Well, that's also from Criterion DVD.
Right.
But they're pretty varied. Josh writes about new movies. I think it's a great fit. There are some things they do the same. Some things, they have a monthly newsstand episode, and then they have occasional. I'm not sure the schedule. I think it's once a month they'll do title episodes like what we're doing here.
Right.
So there will be a few changes. Maybe we should mention the comments that we've gotten since the announcement went out.
Yeah, I mean it's been really positive. Folks saying Doug McCambridge, good news. And we've had a lot of people saying we had Rafael Umana calling us his favorite new podcast. Love hearing comments like that.
Oh, sure.
Great. Yeah. Thanks, Rafael. Mind blown from Angela Elmore. Anthony Elmore.
So, another thing Raphael said is favorite new cast joining his favorite cast for years.
Yes.
So, and that's been the sentiment of a lot of people. Yeah. There was Matthew said, I curse you for me having only a 15-minute commute to work. And I liked Anthony's comment. Is this what it felt like when Cream was formed with Eric Clapton,
Jack Bruce and
Jack Bruce.
Ginger Baker.
Ginger Baker. I was thinking Jay Bruce, the baseball player.
Right.
I probably feels a little different, but we do feel like we're joining a great group of people, very talented. I think, definitely, the best Criterion podcasters out there. I'd say among the best film podcasters out there.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
In good company.
Smart people, passionate people, people that love film. So it's just good to be a part of that that family.
And they like what we like. So there you go.
Right. Go figure.
There was one Rod actually mentioned on Twitter. He said, "Stay true to your roots." And then somebody else said, "Make sure." I think it was Keith said, "Make sure there were not less episodes."
Right.
Keep out. And actually, a couple of people said, "Does this mean you're going to continue your schedule and continue the speed?" And that people like that we do a weekly show
and content. Yeah.
Yes. I think we can safely say that we're not going to subtract anything. Things will change, yes,
mm-hmm.
but and I can't talk about specifically because we're still working all that out, but things are going to change, I think, for the better. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a good marriage. So, and certainly not, you know, like you say, going to be subtracting anything. So,
could be adding, I think, yeah. Very likely. So, in fact, I'd say almost definitely probably adding content to the as we get more entrenched with Criterion Cast and get more settled. We'll definitely be doing a lot of talk about Criterion. So, yeah. So
sometimes it's a, you know, it's a bit of like we've done with this show too, just finding your way and finding what works the best. So, you know, there'll certainly be some you know, maybe some minor changes, but if there is, it'll always be for the better. So,
And all right, well,
cool. Yeah, it's very exciting. And again, I mean, we should say again, thank you to Ryan.
Oh, yes.
You know, for you know, making this happen.
Yes, thank you, Ryan. He's been great. Also, thank you, David and Scott. You know,
love their support too.
Yeah, and we've spoken with all of them, and it's going to be a pleasure. And also Trevor, it's going to be a pleasure being on the team. And I'm sure we'll have some of them on here at some point, doing stuff. So,
More to come. I mean, like you said, we just wanted to get the announcement out there, and there will be, things that that we work out in the future. But it's we're part of the Criterion Cast Network, and very excited. So, it is 2016, so we thought we'd just briefly talk about what we did over the holiday. Aaron, did you do anything exciting? Watch anything good?
Yeah, actually, should we tell people that we are actually podcasting drunk, plastered? Actually, because I don't know when this is going to come out on Criterion Cast, we should also mention that today is January 2nd. So if this comes out on January 7th or 8th, well, I think it'll be earlier than that. But we had a good New Year. If you don't know, I had surgery a couple weeks ago, recovering great. Thank you again, everybody, for the wonderful comments and support. Actually, recovering beyond our best expectations. Yes. So we had a quiet New Year, which fine by me. We get to watch stuff. That's cool. Recently, we got a good deal on Berlin Alexanderplatz. And my wife is actually, she speaks German, and she she does, yeah. Some of the Criterion stuff, you know, she doesn't really get into, but the Fassbinder stuff, she does. She watched Petra von Kant with me last year, so when I got Berlin Alexanderplatz, not even thinking about it, she was excited, and she was like, "Save this one for me."
Nice.
So we started. We watched the first episode of. With my wife, we can't burn through. I could probably go through half the disc,
sure,
in an evening. But we watch. It's an hour and a half. It's really like a movie. Hmm. So, that was not exactly. Fassbinder's not always pleasant. No. Not always nice to women. Which is. Have you seen it?
I haven't. It's one I picked up during the sale. Also, it's one of those few DVD titles I picked up during the Barnes & Noble sale. So it's on the shelf. Hope to get to it.
Yeah. It's Fassbinder. That's all I'll say.
Yeah.
It is good though. I just the first episode. I don't know where they're going, but I kind of get a sense, and I think it's going to be quite a ride. The thing with my wife again, she doesn't. She's more like a movie a day and no more than that, where I could do,
10 movies.
I could wake up and watch them. And,
I hear you.
So actually, and we started early. So after that, I watched Summer Hours, Asaeus, and I hadn't seen that, and I really enjoyed it. Have you seen it?
Yes. Yeah. I like that one quite a bit. Different for Asaeus, but almost, it is a, narrative fiction film, but almost seems like a documentary at times. So I like that film.
Sort of, yeah. He goes, touches on topics that you don't really hear about much. Right. Of course, about a state. When you describe the synopsis of the film is not as interesting as the actual film.
Sure.
I think it was a good ending.
Yes. So, certainly a favorite.
I'd say it was a good movie to begin the new year.
Yeah, exactly. Good tie-in there. You know, it's all about a familial. What did I say? I think on Twitter, a familial end and a beginning.
Yes. So, yes.
Yeah, makes it a lovely ending.
And then we don't fireworks are legal here, so then I just waited for those to end. So I was up late. Are they legal there?
So you could fall asleep. No, they're not.
Okay.
Legal.
Yeah. Yeah, they're everybody in every neighborhood shoots them off here. So yeah. Not us.
Yeah, we hear a little bit, but no, it wasn't too bad. I was able to go to bed earlier, I think.
Okay. So what about you?
Well, the film that I think I don't want to say put me to sleep, but is the one that I watched before bed was a little movie called A Room with a View.
Oh, no, you don't say.
You don't say. A Merchant Ivory film. So that was good to finish that, of course. And I did also watch The Black Stallion. I've been pining to watch that a bit with my daughter. So
right, yeah. How'd she like that?
She did. She liked it. She's one where she sits down and she. I don't know if your wife does this, Aaron, but where she likes to multitask. So she'll be, you know, drawing something or sewing something, but that didn't last that long. She was into the movie.
Okay, good.
You know, after the, she was kind of multitasking during the ship scene a little bit, but she kept watching. And then once they got on the island, she was in. So
I could see that for a kid because you don't, yeah, the ship stuff is more adult, you know, not adult, but you know, more, I guess not children's movie like.
Right.
Whereas, yeah, the stuff on the island is something else. Yeah, I just watched the disc a couple weeks ago, and yeah, it looks terrific.
Yeah, lovely soundtrack, gorgeous. I was, you know, struck up, especially by some of the cinematography on the
Me
island.
Too, yeah.
So, yeah, I think I may have a budding cinephile future Criterion Close-Up, you know, guest on our hands here with my daughter. So.
Oh, really? five-year-old, right. So... I'm trying to think of maybe she can join the children from Fantastic Mr. Fox the supplement there and we'll do an episode.
Certainly.
Now, the first time I saw that was when I was a kid, probably older than her, but so this was the revisiting. Maybe one day, 25 years later, she will revisit this.
Yeah.
And say, "Oh yeah, this is that movie that." Has she talked about it since?
No. I mean, once it's done, she'll talk about it if I bring it up. But
okay, no. Yeah.
She did mention she didn't like the horse racing. She's very animal conscious, and so she doesn't like when, you know, animals are put through something like that. But you know, she did say, as I had said, that the horse race scene was very well shot and exciting. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to say too much more about it in case we do talk about it at some point. But
good point. So. Yeah, let's shut up.
But yeah, so that was New Year's. Watch, we stay in, of course. You know, I've got, having kids at home, I don't go out. Just take it easy. My wife had to work, so but it was very nice hanging out with the family.
Okay, cool. Yeah, a good daddy.
Yes, thank you. So I wanted to mention we were talking to our friend Trevor Barrett from the Mooks and the Gripes about joining us, and unfortunately he wasn't able to join us, so we're calling him the ghost of Trevor again.
Again, like sorry, Trevor. Love you, man. Well, holidays, and we actually didn't book a guest for this for that very reason. We didn't even try for like the last 3 weeks are probably the first three episodes we've done in a while without guests, just because we didn't want to bother people over the holidays. But Trevor had done his master's thesis on A Room with a View. Amazing. And so, you know, he would be the perfect guest. In fact, I almost wish we were doing this in a couple weeks and when he may be more flexible. So, yeah, he would have been a great guest. And I will say that he loved the film. And I think, you know, and he also wrote a review when the disc came out a couple months ago. And I'll go ahead and put his review in the show notes. And I did read it, and he had some good thoughts. I usually don't read reviews before I talk about it.
Right.
But I read his, and it was excellent. Yeah.
Excellent. Cool. So we'll definitely include a link to that. And thank you, Trevor.
The real Trevor will be back someday.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no more ghosts. Yeah.
He will definitely be back on. So I did, speaking of Criterion Cast, I joined the Blu-ray wishlist special. So this is something that Ryan Gallagher organized really way back, I think going back to 2009 or 2010. They've been doing this for quite a few years where they talk about the films in the collection that are on DVD and they would love to see upgraded to Blu-ray high definition in the coming year. Mm-hmm. So, it really ties in well with the show that you were on, which is the looking at the year in review, 2015, favorite discs, Criterion discs of the year. And then this is the looking forward, what they want, would love to see upgraded in 2015. So, that was with Scott Nye, Trevor Barrett, David Blakeslee, and of course, Ryan Gallagher, myself.
It's great, yeah.
So had a lot of fun talking there. And, you know, when we do talk about these, I made a point too, and I know they do too, to really not focus on ones that have been mentioned in the past because they, you know, there are, like I said, numerous episodes going back. And, you know, we joked about how we've been banging the Andrei Rublev drum so much.
That was very, very funny. Yeah. Nice bit there. That drum, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, you know, kind of off topic, there is supposed to be an artificial eye set of all of Tarkovsky's movies, and they all played in, there was a retrospective at BFI South Bank, and they showed, I think, Rublev, and so maybe that drum will finally get to be hung up, and we won't have to worry about that one anymore. Maybe hopefully others. I thought you were excellent on that. In fact, I always love those episodes, just as much as the year end ones.
Yeah, I do too. Yeah, it's fun to look forward to those.
But I remember, and I should also add that Trevor picked some favorites of mine. He also had we had some similar favorites of the year, but he picked Pepe Le Moko, which is a. I'm a huge fan of. That's Duvivier, and he mentioned Jean Gabin is not in the collection.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, it's.
I mean, not well, in, not on Blu-ray. Blu-ray. Yeah, yeah, he's all over DVD. But
I did pick up on one. There is a, of course, he's in French Cancan, which is available in the UK on Blu-ray. But that's the only one.
Not Criterion Blu. Yeah, I know he's in a few other DVDs. He's in. What's that one from the 50s? Touche pas, Grisby?
Grisby, yeah.
Grisby, yeah. By the way, you spoke great French in the episode.
I have to commend you.
For a while,
I've been practicing.
I was waiting for the subtitles.
What does this mean again?
But you picked good ones. You picked Viridiana.
Viridiana and the second film, Les Enfants Terribles from
Melville.
Like I said on the episode, they were really more, looking towards the directors, that had gone out of print, some favorite directors of mine. And I won't jump ahead too much, but they're in the new Wacky New Year's drawing. It looks like we may actually, my wish may be coming true for a Buñuel upgrade. So
possibly, yeah, it's that's a subject in itself, but
we won't delve into that now. But I did wanted to mention too a correction as I was reading off the titles that are out of print for Jean-Pierre Melville. Most of them are, but Le Deuxième Soufflé is not. That's still available on DVD. So just wanted to correct that, a little cross pollination here.
Right, and Le Samurai too, which I think that's already on the iTunes channel, so I would imagine that at some point we'll get upgraded.
Yeah, I hope so.
Both are excellent. There's Alain Delon in Le Samurai, and then Lito Machura in Soufflé. He's good Melville actors, so yes. I would love both of them. Actually, Les Enfants is kind of a different tone.
Than really any of his others, which makes sense, it being written by Jean Cocteau. But
right, yeah, yeah. It kind of seems like a Cocteau film in a way.
Yes, so. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, that was good episode. We'll put that in the show notes as well, and I recommend everybody listen to that and the year end one, which I was on. So that was good. Not really for me, but we had 5-6 people on that one as well. So
yeah.
That was
really busy episodes. Really good panel. That was nice. So, and we do have a special guest we wanted to finally clarify for next week's episode, where we're talking to Bruce Beresford films from 1980, 1990. So who's that guest going to be? Aaron, someone you know well, I think.
Well, this guest pointed out when we were vague about it, that the last time we were vague about a guest, it was Alex Cox.
Right.
And this guest didn't want, this guest is going to be my wife. My wife. I can't do a Borat. My wife. I can't do it. You know, it's going to be my wife. She is a English professor. She is a Jeopardy champion, and she happens to teach post-colonial themed classes. So these two films, you know, it's not really, it's, we're not, this is not podcast nepotism here. She is probably about the best person I could think, the most qualified to talk about these two films. And she, I don't believe she's seen Mr. Johnson, but she has seen Breaker Morant, and okay, we'll have a lot to say about it. So
nice.
That'll be fun.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Little adding the family to the podcast, but you know, like you said, someone that knows what she's talking about. So that's going to be fun. I can't wait to see how you guys are set up, sharing a microphone and all that. So that'll be cool.
We have a thing for that, so you'll see.
Cool.
So my wife, your daughter, it is becoming a family a family show. So
cool. So that'll be next week. And the last thing we wanted to mention is we're not covering the news this week, just not a lot of news, of course, with the holiday. And we will include a link to the New Year's drawing with the wacky drawing that was submitted by Criterion. Really, I believe it was on New Year's Eve, if I remember.
They came out with it on Thursday this week. Year. Yeah. Is it always on Thursday?
I thought it was always on the first, but you know, maybe always on Thursday, with that being you know, being
a Friday, being
a holiday. Yeah, I'm not sure what, but yeah. And they posted it early too. It was like first thing Thursday morning, so it's early.
Extremely early. Yeah. So and I think Criterion Cast will talk about that. So we'll link to the drawing, and they have a lot of guesses. Of course, you know, not everything is clear and dry. That's why it's fun to talk about and speculate, like you mentioned with the Benwell. So,
right.
Even though we're not going to do news, I do want to mention that Haskell Wexler passed away. In fact, he passed away. I saw it right after we stopped recording last week, and it popped up in my little news feed as we were winding down. And I mentioned, oh man, that's terrible. So he was older. I think was he 93?
Yeah, older than I had realized, but yeah, it's unfortunate.
Big Criterion staple, of course. Medium Cool is his big, big personal directorial work. But you know, as a cinematographer, he's been around too, and has a few titles. I know he was involved with Days of Heaven, but not the. I think he was an additional photographer.
Right.
And same with The Rose and Medium Cool. I believe that's it. I didn't actually check because I didn't know we were going to...
As far as collection connections, of course, he's known for a lot of other films, like One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and She's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And
The Confession, I believe.
Yeah. So unfortunate to see that.
I said The Confession. I meant The Conversation.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So, yeah. I knew what you meant.
Yeah, thanks. I hope the listeners did.
Sorry to say
rest
that.
In peace, yeah.
So let's we usually take a break, Aaron, but with not having the longer news, should we just jump into the review?
Yeah, let me just take a deep breath here. All right. Yeah, let's get right to it. Do you want to play a little music just to...
Sure. Yeah, we probably should. We can take a little break here. Welcome back, everyone. We are here on Criterion Close-Up, episode 22, talking about the Merchant Ivory film, A Room with a View. So...
Yeah, I don't have a room. I don't have a room. I don't have a view in this room. My view is a TV, Amrecord poster, some Criterions on the shelf here in front of me.
You could do worse than a view like that. That's pretty nice for an interior view.
And do you have a view?
Well, I've got. I'm on the second floor where I podcast. I'm actually in my man cave, my movie room. So this is my space. Yeah. Not much of a review, just the neighborhood. So
I was going to offer to trade you, so you have my room.
I'll just take your posters, if that's okay.
You can't have those. That view is mine.
Oh, so, I'll take your Criterions, too, if that's
that
okay.
View is especially mine. So I think you have most of them anyway.
No, you're right. Yeah, I'd be doubling up. That would be that would be greedy. So.
Yep. Well, a room with a view.
So yeah, apparently it is a 1986 film. I had some trouble kind of confirming this because I think IMDb says 85, and then it's noted as 86 in the UK and on the Criterion site. So we'll go with 86, I guess. Director James Ivory, producer Ishmael Merchant, of course, novel writer E.M. Forster from the 1908 novel, and a screenplay by Ruth Prower Jabvala, I believe it is. Also a mainstay for the Merchant Ivory production. So of course we'll be talking about that in a little bit. But
yep,
spine number 775, and I'll just give a brief synopsis. Always interesting with the Merchant Ivory films. Lucy Honeychurch and chaperone Charlotte Bartlett find themselves in Florence with rooms without views. Fellow guests Mr. Emerson and son George step in to remedy the situation, as we already set up really. Mm-hmm. And meeting the Embersons could change Lucy's life forever, but once back in England, how will her experiences in Tuscany affect her marriage plans? That is the big question.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and we probably should mention to any new listeners that we are spoiler-free here. We'll wait a little bit. You know, we won't. You can listen for the next 10-15 minutes and not worry about, finding out how half the cast dies.
No, spoiler alert.
but yeah, just FYI. So yeah, and this movie had a lot of Oscar nominations. Very celebrated film. I know it was nominated for, it had 8 nominations actually, and it won 3. Best costume design, best screenplay, best art direction. Before we get into it, do you think these were fair? Do you think these were deserved?
I think so. I mean, for sure. I mean, it's I could see almost any Merchant Ivory film being winning for costume design and art direction. And you know, really, when you take something like an E.M. Forster novel and adapt it, mm-hmm. Not to downplay Ruth's work, but I mean, it's just some great prose. So. Certainly see it winning. I did want to mention, I'll mention after some of the other ones, because I think there's some good, interesting nominations too. But what did you think, Aaron? I thought, I was looking at some of the other movies that it won against, and some of them I hadn't seen. I, of course, did notice that Crimes of the Heart is there, another Bruce Beresford.
Are you talking about screenplay?
So. Yes.
Yeah, I think costume design and art direction are, I don't want to say no-brainers because I don't know what was nominated against, but yeah, those make sense. But screenplay is a pretty big award. I'd say that's a major award.
Yeah, a major award.
Which Crimes of the Heart? Yeah, I saw that one. It did. I don't think it's aged as well. Hmm.
Stand By Me. I mean, I could see someone going up against that one.
That's
for
a
sure,
tough one. But, yeah.
From of course, based on the Stephen King novel, but.
Mm-hmm. The body, yeah, or the story, the novella, I guess.
Right.
And then Children of a Lesser God, The Color of Money. So I've seen all of these. Some have aged better than others. Mm-hmm. I'd say Stand By Me has probably aged the best of that bunch.
I haven't seen Children of a Lesser God. It's been a long time for The Color of Money, but Stand By Me seems like it's the one that would butt heads the most with A Room with a View. But having just seen A Room with a View and Stand By Me not too long ago, I certainly support it. I think it's a good pick.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
some of the other
it's fair.
Yeah, some of the other nominations. I mean, it was nominated for Picture, Best Supporting Actor in Denholm Elliott.
Right, Mr. Emerson. Yeah.
Yes, and we'll talk about some of the actors, but supporting actress was Maggie Smith, also nominated. James Ivory did get nominated for director and cinematography. Tony Pierce Roberts, all nominated. So,
yeah, very celebrated and 3 wins. Major success, you should say. Major box office success, which is for a period piece. Actually, this was really the. We might as well talk about the Merchant Ivory career. This was really the watershed for their career. Prior, of course, they'd been working. I don't know, have it in front of me, but I believe 20 years prior to this or something They started in India.
Yeah, I think you're right, Aaron. If I remember, the first film was 1963. So, yeah, just over 20 years. Yep.
And they had done a lot of, they started doing films in India, migrated to England. And I think I haven't seen a lot of the earlier films. I've seen some. But they maybe took a little bit of time to find their footing. But, you know, then they moved on to sort of period pieces. I remember the Bostonians, the Europeans. They're pretty well regarded for Heat and Dust, I believe, was pretty well regarded. And, the Bostonians was right before A Room with a View. And then, but I don't think any of those had the budget of a room with a View. I don't quote me on that part. I didn't go through the list and look at the budget.
Right.
At least on the screen, from what I remember of the older films, and seeing A Room with a View, I did notice a big difference. And I should add, this is my third time seeing A Room with a View. Had you seen it before?
No, first time for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm not as well versed in Merchant Ivory. Actually, the only other one that I've seen is Howard's End. I think some of it by reputation, just for the slow period costume drama. So,
Merchant Ivory is an adjective, really.
You
can talk about in fact, Downton Abbey. People would probably use Merchant Ivory to discuss that. So anyway, Ismail Merchant, who passed about 10 years ago, he was the producer. James Ivory was the director. Ruth Prower Jabala was the writer, usually, not always, or the adapter. It pretty much always adapted screenplays from, whether it was Henry James or Forster or Ishiguro. So, I think you could safely say, some people might argue, but probably A Room with a View ushered in their peak period. I think really for the next decade or so that they had, of course, they had this, they had Morris, which was formerly on the Criterion Collection. Let me see, they had Howard's End is the big one. Well, is a big one. And then Remains of the Day, which I happened to have rewatched last night. That was probably one of the last big ones. Surviving Picasso was 96, and that was not as well received. I remember liking it. That was another Hopkins film. But some of their work, Le Divorce was not too well regarded. The White Countess, I'd say, was okay. Have you seen that?
Mm-mm.
That was 2005. No. And then, of course, Merchant passed. And James Ivory has continued to work some. In fact, I saw he's developing Richard II, so we'll see how that goes. I don't know if you... it really is a company. We can get into the auteurship, but you could argue that all three had a piece in the auteurship. Maybe not.
It's interesting, Aaron. There was a quote that I had seen. This is from Merchant, where he's talking about that kind of strange marriage, as he calls it. And just from backgrounds, you have, Merchant is an Indian Muslim, Ruth, who's a German Jew, and then Jim is a Protestant American. So, merging those three together, of course, and he calls them, described as a three-headed god. Maybe they should be called a three-headed monster. But it is interesting, that between the three of them that they, were able to, of course, work together for so long. I mean, it's the longest, I believe. It has the...
Very long.
It's in the Guinness Book of World Records for the longest, filmmaking team, really, in Merchant Ivory. But, as we said, Ruth is also part of that team from a screenwriting standpoint. So,
very impressive. What's interesting is we talked to Alex Cox a few weeks ago, and I think he referred to it as posh garbage.
Yes.
And I will say that Merchant Ivory, it's proper period piece. You have your costumes. It's very English upper class usually. Actually, not always. A lot of times they have something to say. We'll get into that. But. It's not like, hey, let's go to that Merchant Ivory movie. It's at least for me, even though I, but once you start watching the films, you know, you do get sucked in a little bit.
Yeah, it's hard not to be engaged. Yeah, it's like you said, it's hard to get excited to watch it, but once you're there, you know. And I've kind of turned around a little bit, having seen a couple of now. I look forward to them now. We'll talk mm-hmm. about the disc more, but you know, these films are made for the high definition Blu-ray medium, I think. So
for sure, yeah. And I should mention that I watched Remains of the Day on Twilight Time, which was a great release, but Criterion lost the rights to, well, to everything. The only Blu-ray they had in print was Howard's End, is out of print. There was a little bit of nastiness with the production company, or maybe it's intertwined with the estate. I don't know, but I think there was a lawsuit of some sort. Of course, I don't know how it was resolved, but you know, things are out of print.
Mm-hmm.
So when this came, when this one was announced, it was kind of a surprise. And the fact that James Ivory participated is even more of a surprise. The majority of the films have now, a couple months ago, were announced. They're going to go to Cohen Media Group, and that includes Howard's End, Morris, not Remains of the Day, because that's already Twilight Time. And then a lot of the ones I already mentioned, in fact, a lot of the early ones. So,
yeah,
going to get, I think, 30 films total. So a lot of Merchant Ivory going to come out in the next few years elsewhere,
yeah,
not Criterion. So
it was interesting how, you know, when those went out of print, the Howard's End was the only one, I believe, with a spine number. And then the rest were, you know, ones that's part of what they called, the Merchant Ivory collection.
Right.
So
that's true. Yeah.
Just a different kind of offshoot. So. Well, so should we get into the cast a little bit? You know, it's there's quite a few people. We've got Helena Bonham Carter, Julian Sands, Maggie Smith, Denholm Elliott, Simon Callow. Folks might know him as the friend from Amadeus of Mozart. Daniel Day-Lewis, and so quite the cast there. We have a mix of new and older actors that, you know, it's something that is mentioned. I, you know, don't want to talk too much about the supplements. Oh, but
also, Judi Dench.
I think I missed that one.
I think I did too. Rupert Graves. Yeah, there is a kind of a who's who and some younger actors. In fact, I think Judi Dench was just starting. She hadn't done many films at that point.
Right.
Maggie Smith, of course, had done plenty. And then Carter, Sands were young. Elliot Callow had done plenty. Lewis was at the beginning of his career.
Dench was more of a stage actress up until this time, but so it's interesting, they talked about this in the supplements, how they find new talent like Helena Bonham Carter and Julian Sands, but also love the skill of mature acting like Maggie Smith and Judi Dench, as we mentioned. So it's a nice combination of the two, and they do get their time in separate scenes too, which is a good mm-hmm. stroke. He mixes the actors together, but also has them apart, interacting some. So yeah, and I would say too, Aaron, I felt like if you wanted to pick some actors that are kind of tailor-made for Merchant Ivory films, I mean, can you pick better actors than Judi Dench and Maggie Smith? I mean,
right, like, yeah. Well, perfect. Of course, now Maggie Smith is Dowager Countess, and you know, they've, I think probably all of these actors have been in Harry Potter some degree or another.
That's right.
But that does not have much in common with Merchant Ivory.
No.
But yeah, they all fit very well, and even Callow, Elliot, I think they're all excellent, and I think they do well in the period piece.
Yeah.
And then the younger actors, of course, Sands might have made some questionable choices during his career. He had Warlock and Boxing Helena. And then, of course, Bonham Carter went on to do a lot of Tim Burton films. She's had quite a career, but this
Fight Club, and of course, Harry Potter, like you mentioned.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember if this was her first film. It was not.
It was her second film. The first one was a TV movie that she had done. So yeah, she was talking about how she really was trying to finish her degree, and she kept getting pulled into film, so to speak. So, I thought the other interesting thing was they talked about how some of the backers originally, they were actually looking to pull the plug because they wanted to have really bigger actors in the film, like John Travolta playing George and Glenn Close playing Lucy. So that would have been interesting.
I can't see that. Were they going to dance on the piazza, staying alive?
I think so.
Or was she going to murder him in the final scene?
Would have been a different film.
Very different. Well, I obviously they would have put on the costumes, but I can't see that. Remains of the Day had Christopher Reeve in it, so they do sometimes mix in American actors, but
I really liked some of the. I mean, one of the actors that stood out to me, of course, was I think Judi Dench and Maggie Smith, of course, and as you mentioned, Simon Callow. I thought he brought some really good humor to the role. Similar to we saw him in Amadeus, I just thought he was a nice kind of bridge between the old and the new. He interacted well with all of the different characters, and so I liked that a lot. There was a beautiful.
He was sort of the bridge character, I think, between many of the parties. But that's right. He was in Amadeus, Four Weddings and a Funeral. A very successful career, but I think playing supporting actors or supporting characters mostly.
Certainly, I liked, and of course the elephant in the room a bit, Aaron, is Daniel Day-Lewis in an early
early
role.
Again, we talked about this role with Mr. Cox a couple weeks ago, because Lewis was auditioning for Sid and Nancy. I couldn't recall. I think the timeline is muddled, but we're not sure if he had done this film yet, or if he had done it and it hadn't come out. Cox mentioned that of course Lewis had just done Beautiful Laundrette, which is where he plays kind of a skinhead but with hair, a very lower class, and he does it well, I think. Alex was not a fan of either role, so I'll just move on from his opinion on that. I respect his opinion, of course, but. And then for this role, upperclassman, Lewis was actually the son of a poet laureate, so he was upperclassman. But he did ratchet it up a good bit. I can't see him as being this snooty and this, shall we go with the proverbial stick up where?
Yes.
Standing so tall, speaking down to everybody, had that, he probably did raise his nose, literally.
Yeah,
but,
there's a few scenes where you kind of saw him, keeping his head up a bit. It was a little bit, knowing this actor so much now, it felt a little bit early on, like I could get on board with it, with what Alex was saying, where he seems to be, acting.
Right. Chewing scenery.
But I think as it went along, and I was thinking to myself, to put my notes, is he really acting the part of the character, or is acting the part as the actor? So that, which probably doesn't make sense, but I'm just, curious.
I get it.
Is he overacting in fits? And I'd be curious to know, like, which parts were actually, filmed first and later. But I think he really settled into it. And I think once you're on board with a character, it's something I always struggle with, especially with a known face, is, getting to really just look at them as a character rather than the actor playing the character. And I thought he did a great job. There's a, I know, again, the supplements, how Helena Bonham Carter is talking about him. Really, you could see him, that he's going to be a great one, almost like, almost like a coming out party, I guess, but really just a star about to break.
He really did. I won't say he stole his scenes, but he was a huge presence, and actually not only a huge presence, but he is so tall.
Yeah, didn't realize it really until this film.
Yeah, there are a few scenes, and he had that kind of long-legged, skinny look frame, which actually fit with the character very well. Yep. You know, kind of towering over everybody. But yeah, physically and I guess verbally or I lost my word, but no, I think he was. I prefer him in Laundrette.
Yeah,
I think that's a better performance, but it's so different.
Yeah.
And of course, after this, he would go on to do My Left Foot. You know, he did Last of the Mohicans. He did In the Name of the Father.
Yeah, I forget some of those 90 films. Of course, people know him from, you know, There Will Be Blood and
Yeah,
you know, the late ones with
Gangs of New York,
of course. You
know, Abraham Lincoln. Yeah. Now I think he's become. He's most certainly a great actor and one of the greats. But I think if you accused him of overacting and being hammy, I think you would. That's fair. Sometimes I think Gangs of New York for sure.
But you know this is where he. I mean, I don't know. I liked him quite a bit. I certainly was on board with him, and I thought he was, you know, funny. One of the funny actors, not really trying to be, but he. He was. I mean, I love that scene where he's. It's a great shot too, where Maggie Smith is looking out and he's just swatting at a bee. I mean, it's just encapsulates the character so well.
Little things, and I think part of it is the character was well drawn too. You know, but almost you know, hyper developed. I remember the scene where he's speaking with the Emersons about the rental, and of course they are I mean, anybody that can afford a nice hotel in Florence has money.
Right.
But they're not seen as the same traditional upbringing or the gentlemanly class as he is. And he had his cane and top hat. And I remember he was talking to them in a museum, I believe it was. And every time somebody walked by with a top hat, he would look at them and nod while Emerson was speaking. So the little things really did sparkle in the performance and the character. I think it was quite a character.
Yeah, agreed. So, you know, you kind of alluded to it a bit, Aaron, with the world view of the different characters and how they see the world, their place in the world, their status, so to speak. We thought we'd talk about some of the characters like Charlotte, Cecil, Mrs. Chunnyhurt, Honeychurch, which is Lucy's mother, and of course the Emersons, George and Mr. Emerson. We don't really learn his first name. Lucy and Mr. Beebe, they really seem to have a kind of a different worldview. So what did you think of them?
Well, you know, it is, I mean, it's definitely a class conflict, again, among the upper classes. There are no poor people here, but it's varying, I guess, outlooks of people of different, you know, wealth. It's not a good movie, but I do think of, at least it's not a good movie to me, but I think of the character in Titanic that did not seem to earn her money.
Brown, yes. It's you mentioned her because I had her in my notes too. She certainly stood out as a, you know, kind of the, like Mr. Emerson, a bit of a nonconformist.
Right.
Absolutely.
Sort of a rabble-rouser, but not really, I mean, not intentionally. Emerson's very good natured, and he's not trying to get in the middle. He's just trying to enjoy life on his terms. He's not conforming to you know, these rules that that people from hundreds of years ago have put into place, and that you know, people are following. But he obviously has some money, and then George, his son Julian Sands, is more of a deep thinker. You know, at one point he asks Lucy, Helena Bonham Carter, to spend some time with him so that George doesn't brood so much.
Right.
So I think he's more of a romantic. I mean, yeah, for sure he's a romantic.
Yeah, quiet and, you know, but passionate too. I mean, he's got some, you know, some louder scenes where he's proclaiming the eternal yes.
Yes, he is.
So, yeah, it was good. There, you know, and there's, like you said, like with Mr. Emerson, he talks about how it's ridiculous, these niceties, so to speak. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't quite subscribe to them, and he just wants to enjoy, you know, this life. I also, you know, from their kind of perspective, I would say, I mean, you alluded to how they still have money, but I think the film goes, I don't want to say out of its way, but it does allude to the size of the well, the first they call it a cottage, and they call it a villa.
Sure, sure. You know, yeah, they don't have as much money. No, that's right. There's no doubt. I just meant relatively, yeah, compared to people of England at this time.
Right, right. And really just, you know, the only point I wanted to make there was just looking at the house. It was, they did a good job of the way they shot it. Like, they showed George going up the stairs, and it's a very tight staircase. You know, everything is instead of being these grand open rooms, it's these tight rooms. Within the, you know, the villa, there's the shot there later about how, you know, that where they're moving out, where it shows, you know, just again, a small room in a, like a living room with the fireplace. So, you know, it's just a non-verbal showing of this, you know, this area.
And I think that with the set design, as you mentioned, and also with the camera work, and this is something Trevor pointed out in his review that I'll put a link to it, as I mentioned, is that they do use film language to show how shut in people are. And of course, I think you could say that that Lucy is in the middle, and we'll get to the other extreme here in a moment. But yep. Lucy is sort of caught in between, and what Trevor mentioned is how the glimmer of light when they find their room with a view in the morning, the light shines on her, and you know, and that's still, and there's actually a picture of that in the photo album. You do see her kind of trapped between two worlds, and I think a lot of those little touches are intentional.
Yeah.
So the other world is really her mother and Cecil Weiss, I think, are the main people on the other side. Before we get to them, let's play a clip of Mr. Emerson. The movie begins with Charlotte, which is Maggie Smith, talking about how this room is not satisfactory. and yes, she's quite a character, Charlotte. Yeah. And then at a dinner party, there is a little background noise. There, few scenes here don't have background noise, but they're at a dinner or a formal dinner, and he volunteers his room to the ladies. So I'll play this clip here.
I don't know why we're arguing, because we don't have it. We have no view.
I have a view. I have a view. So does George. My son George here. You can have our rooms, and we'll have yours. We can change. But why shouldn't you have them?
Thank you very much indeed. We could not impose on your kindness.
Why?
You see, we wouldn't...
Hush, Lucy.
Women like looking at a view. Men don't. George, persuade them.
It's obvious they should have the rooms. There's nothing else to say.
Signora?
No, thank you.
Why shouldn't you change? We can clear out in half an hour, 15 minutes. It's ridiculous, these niceties. They go against common sense, every kind of sense. I don't care what I see outside. My vision is within. Here is where the birds sing. Here is where the sky is blue.
So this is one of the scenes where I think he really expresses his worldview. You know, he expresses some themes I think we'll touch on. He's not in tune with people like Cecil Weisz. He's more his own man, going after his own things. What do you think of Mr. Emerson?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly agree there. I thought he was kind of endearing too, and I liked how, you know, you mentioned how Lucy's kind of in the middle where, you know, Charlotte certainly seems to look down on him.
And,
you know, react negatively, but, you know, Lucy really points out how he was trying to be nice.
Right.
You know, so it's really her story, and Mr. Emerson is, you know, certainly a part of that with George. But they're kind of foils for each other, Charlotte and Mr. Emerson. I thought he was certainly one of the actors that stood out, and of course he garnered a nomination for it, Denholm Elliott. I was thinking of on the other side with Charlotte. She seems to be more concerned with fairness. You know, that scene kind of plays into that, how, you know, she didn't want to be indebted to him by, you know, taking the
Charlotte
room.
I'd say she is an obvious manipulator. I think with the room, you know, she has something in mind. There are a few instances of this. The most memorable, I think, are well, of course, the room. You know, she didn't want to Well, actually, at first she did automatically reject it, but then later she, you know, of course, she really wanted the room with a view,
right?
And that's what she was going for. And then there's the scene with them in the field, and they lay down the little square for them to sit on, mm-hmm. and she offers it to Lucy, and then says and then kind of guilts her, saying, it's okay. If my rheumatoid arthritis flares up, I'll just stand. And Lucy ignores it, and then later she coughs and says, "Oh, don't worry, I'm not. It's not because of me not sitting on the thing." She's very, very obvious, and then the cab scene, the cab paying scene,
yes,
where
it stands out. It's so drawn out. It's funny too. You know, it's hilarious. So she's so concerned again with fairness and just paying the taxi proper and having the right change. And
I think it's the other way around. I think she puts on airs of being concerned with fairness, but she really does want them to pay the cab for her, and that's. Right. And that's why, every time, she's like, "Oh no, you must not pay the cab." I mean, and I think the family is used to it, and they're not falling for it. So they make her pay. And actually, yeah. Cecil, who has plenty of money, takes the crown, or not? Yeah, the what do they call it?
Oh, I'm not sure.
It was really the pound, but
because
15 shillings and five make a pound.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, I was a little lost. Not of course. Everything I buy is in pounds from Masters right. of Cinema and Amazon UK. But
right. We don't deal with shillings too often. Yeah,
no, not that often.
But on the other hand, she tended to look down on everybody else. I would say she was not a very endearing character. She was funny, remember everybody said poor Charlotte, but she was not somebody we would look at as being virtuous.
No.
I think that was, again, transparent. We could see right through it. But the Emersons, who are genuinely nice people, she can't see them as nice people because they are of a different persuasion. They have a different worldview.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Dench, her companion friend, is not quite of that worldview. She's also kind of a I don't know. What would you think of a Dench?
The Judy Dench character, Eleanor Lavish, she has, she moves things along in more of, I don't know if you'd say carnal way, but she's certainly interested in finding characters for her book, as she alludes to, and even refers to Lucy in that way. So I think she certainly has a note of properness about her, but she is more in tune, I think, with the world, so to speak. So I thought as far as the scenes go, between one of the most gorgeous shots is with Charlotte and with Eleanor Lavish just sitting there in the field eating their eating their fruit. It's really nice.
And what's funny is she does encourage the gossip, and she does, but of course she has a motive. She's writing all this down. This is her book. So I think she's I think in a way she takes advantage of Charlotte. Charlotte sees herself as being, she doesn't see herself as naive. She sees herself as being the authority on everything.
Mm-hmm.
Even if, maybe her life hasn't turned out the way she planned it, because she's obviously alone. Or maybe it has. I think she actually wishes that same thing for Lucy. Stay away from men.
Right. Yeah.
But
I certainly feel that.
But yeah, it's interesting dynamic there. But maybe we should move on to the other side. I think the mother and Cecil are very much the old school aristocratic. Do you want to take it?
Yeah, sure. They're certainly and they're a little bit foils for each other. Like you said, old school aristocratic. But they also. Mrs. Honeychurch is. She refers to she's not artistic, literary, or intellectual, whereas Cecil would consider himself very much so. He's always got his nose in a book. He can't be bothered with physical activity, like playing, it's not tennis, but, really playing sports. And he almost can't be bothered with Lucy, his fiancée.
He can't be bothered with much of anything, actually.
Yes, but himself.
But himself. Very, yeah. Very proud individual. A very proud gentleman. Well, maybe this is a good time to play the Tea Party clip. I have to set it up a little bit. This is in the middle of a tea party, so there is, again, some background noise, and there's really two conversations going on. One between Lucy and her mother, and another party, just somebody that happens to be at the party. And then later, Cecil speaks. But first, you see how her mother feels about the other pair of people, the Allens, which were two ladies that Lucy liked in Florence. So, and right. Then the second part of the clip, you can just barely hear it on the audio, but somebody asks Cecil what his occupation is, and then we get to hear good old Cecil. So here it is.
I love it.
Harry, how would you like spinsters as tenants in Sissy Villa?
Oh, most certainly. That is, if they are gentlewomen.
Oh, indeed they are. They're at present homeless, so they write. Miss Teresa, Miss Catherine Allen. I met them in Italy.
Oh, Sir Harry, beware of these gentlewomen. Beware of women altogether, only let to a man. Provided, of course, he's clean.
Mother, you'd be the first to love them, Miss Allens.
I don't think I like anyone at that pensione of yours. I mean, wasn't there a lady novelist and a free-thinking father
what
and
What is your profession, Mr. Weiss?
I have no profession. My attitude, quite an indefensible one, is that so long as I'm no trouble to anyone, I have the right to do as I like. It is, I dare say, an example of my decadence.
You're very fortunate. The possession of leisure is a wonderful opportunity.
So yes, of course, the mother doesn't want to even think about the people she met in Florence. Those are not her type of people. And then right. Cecil is proud of not working or not having to work. You know, that's his decadence.
Very much so.
Would you call him a decadent fellow?
Oh yeah, I would say so. I mean, you know, like you said, he's just so into himself, and his occupation is being a man of leisure. So
right.
Yeah. I love that scene. That's one of the ones that absolutely, you know, stuck out to me. There's another one too, really, with Lucy, and this is later on, but where she's referring to how she comes into money, you know, next year, I believe it is. It's, you know, I think she's really coming of age at that
right,
point.
Right.
I just, you know, I thought to myself, and I said to myself, oh, this life, you know, this. life of leisure, this coming into money next year, you know, where that's where you really kind of come into your own, so to speak. And I mean, there's a sense of independence coming to her. It seems like, you know, Cecil is already there where, you know, he's at that point. But I know, I'm not sure the character's name, but, you know, they refer to the possession of leisure being a wonderful opportunity. So, yeah.
Sure.
I'm hoping someday, Aaron, that I can, you know, be in possession of leisure too. How about you?
Sure, I'd take it. I've just podcast all day and watch Criterion.
Right.
Right, exactly. But of course, the filmmakers are not portraying these as negative beliefs or worldviews. In fact, they portray them very much as being hypocritical because, you know, Cecil complains about everything. I mean, he's just a nuisance. You know, he's so egotistical, speaks so highly of himself. Really, I don't think he really ever has anything positive to say about anybody else. And in fact, there's the one scene when he's talking about how terrible the tea party is, and then he catches himself and he goes, "Oh, but you know, at least I get to talk to you," you
right.
know, his wife. And of course, then she says, "Why are you so cross all the time?" And it's true. Why is he? Well, it's because you know he has affluenza.
That's right. He's just so just so into himself. I mean, you almost wonder what Lucy saw in him, but I kind of feel like she never really saw that much in him, other than you know, the feeling of duty that she
right.
has to marry someone like Cecil rather than and. You know, and she's been told to turn her nose up to the passion of someone like George.
Right. And that's instilled on her upon by Charlotte. And remember, towards the end right. of them leaving Florence, George is about to come in the room, and Charlotte just blocks him completely. And then they cut to England. And so, yeah, she's seen... the romantic life is not available to her.
So. Yeah. Yeah, and but they allude to the fact that she has some burgeoning, I guess you could say, I don't know if it's romanticism, but passion, because she loves to play. I mean, she plays the piano.
Yeah. Oh, right.
And, you know, of course, you know, Mr. Beebe refers to, you know, if she ever was able to, you know, marry her life with the passion of, you know, say Beethoven, that be something to see.
Actually, let's play that clip, Mr. Beebe, speaking with Cecil about the engagement.
Some tea. Do you suppose I shall get it?
Food is the one thing one does get here.
Extraordinary thing.
One of Freddy's bones.
Oh, Fred is terrible. Most unpromising youth. So unlike his sister.
You think his sister is promising?
I have a pet theory about Miss Honeychurch. Does it not strike you as odd that she should play so wonderfully, play Beethoven with such passion, and live so quietly? I suspect one day... music and life will mingle. And then she will be wonderful in both.
I trust that day is at hand. She has just promised to marry me. I'm sorry if I've given you a shock.
No, I really am most awfully sorry. I had no idea you were so intimate with her. Really, Mr. Vyse, you should have stopped me. Shall we join the others?
So, yeah, Mr. Beebe, I think, was on track about her. And also, Mr. Beebe, again, kind of like Lucy, sort of, he's a vicar, for one, but... So I guess you could say he's not very wealthy, or at least not you know, he's a man of the church.
Sure.
But I think he's seen as more of a voice of reason in the film. So.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, and he's I found him and probably Charlotte to be, well, and really Cecil to be some of the you know, the most humorous elements in the film, and well, and really Eleanor Lavish in some of her, you know, the way she describes, you know, the world, and, you know, talking about her book, and I just love Charlotte's, you know, reaction of, you know, of course,
poor Charlotte. Yeah. No, Charlotte. Actually, it is a comedy in a lot of ways. Yeah. It is a very, very funny movie.
Yeah. And it's a dry comedy, obviously, but, you know, there are those elements in there.
Oh, sure, yeah. I have to backtrack. I said there are no wealthy people in the film, or no poor people. I forgot about Italy.
Yes.
There are a lot of poor people in Italy, and I remembered when, you know, when she's going into the museum, and by the way, I love that scene with Mr. Emerson, too, where Mr. Emerson is interrupting another... Right. Not an aristocratic, but a high and mighty priest. But there are people trying to bother Lucy, and she is, you know, get away from me, and I don't want to deal with you. And then later she witnesses a particularly gruesome act of violence. So in the piazza there in Florence, in front of the museum, and then and then George, of course, comes along. So how did you see her interacting with these two worlds, and even her photographs interacting with that she'd taken? She drops them in the midst of the carnage here. So yeah. What were your thoughts of this?
I mean, certainly it's her first interaction with, you know, that kind of, you know, well, maybe her first interaction with the lower class even, but certainly her first interaction with violence and how that level in the world. I thought it was interesting how you see the men, I would call them even the Hurts, the men covered with black masks with, you know, two holes, almost looks like a KKK members, but with black masks.
Yeah, in a way.
That was an interesting piece, but, you know, it really is eye-opening for her, because, you know, she has had that sheltered life. Mm-hmm. And to see something like this, I mean, you're not really surprised by her reaction, you know, actually being so close to it. I mean, she's a bit of a stranger in a strange land in Florence as a tourist, but you know, it shows her that you know, there are these pieces. I mean, I even thought of in that scene a bit of course it's in color, but of Italian neorealism to an extent.
Sure,
you just kind of have that, you know, just for that that particular scene.
And I thought the way it was filmed, you know, it goes from seeing a museum and seeing all these gorgeous paintings, and then we see the exterior, and they show a lot of just brief shots of the statues and then you see an overhead shot of the piazza, and it just looks like another tourist area. It really is a tourist area. But you know, then you notice there are pigeons there. You know, there are people walking around. These are not people like Lucy, Charlotte, Mr. Beebe, or even the Embersons. These are lower class people. And of course, then you see them. You see the man get assaulted and murdered, and then you see them washing him in this fountain. You know, and the fountain is actually a beautiful fountain. So that's another place that a tourist might go. But you know, it kind of I think mixes in the world of this. And of course, back in this period, tourism really was, you know, later they mentioned the world of bicycles have revolutionized things.
Right.
Travel. So getting to Italy is especially difficult. So and that's really it. We don't really see anything quite nearly as vulgar, but they're out of this scene, they're back into their world. And I think it is interesting. Her initial reaction is she faints and George rescues her. But then when she comes to terms with it, I thought the reactions of the two characters were quite the way they were different. Do you remember this?
No.
Well, her reaction was at first.
Is it the shot where they're looking, the lower angle shot?
Good shot. Very good shot. She is, and I have to say this, when I listen to the scene back, I almost cringed at some of the acting in this scene. You know, of course, both would become very good actors, but they were not at their best here. But as far as how they reacted to the scene, she at first moved on. She was like, as if, oh, this happened, but you know, this happens. And then George said, and I think I have a little clip. I'll play a little clip. But George has been changed by this event, and you know, it's, and of course that speaks to his personality. He's so moved by everything, and and he vocalizes it. And so this might be actually the turning point in Lucy. Well, maybe not, because she marries Cecil, but
isn't it extraordinary? I mean, Italians are so kind, so lovable, and yet at the same time so violent. Miss Emerson? I've never been so much ashamed of myself in my life. I can't think what came over me.
It's perfectly natural. I nearly fainted myself.
Well, I owe you 1,000 apologies. And I want to ask you as a great favor. You know how silly people are. Gossiping. Ladies especially, I'm afraid. You understand what I mean?
No.
I mean, would you not mention it to anyone? My foolish behavior.
Something tremendous has happened.
Well, thank you. Again. How quickly these accidents do happen. And then one returns to the old life.
I don't. I mean, something's happened to me. And to you.
Yeah, well, and it feels like she's, you know, again doing that out of duty, but it does seem a little odd.
Yeah. So Italy and then in England are very, very different places. At least they're Italy and they're England. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I really liked. There's some of the camera work in Italy was beautiful, like you alluded to, like the opening shot, which is probably a helicopter shot, not necessarily a crane shot, but there are, I love the handheld shots in the carriages too. There is a little bit of a clash there too, where you have the Italian drivers who are told to separate I was trying to think of, you know, where there are those moments, because we do get more of that, and not to talk much about Howard's End, but one of the reasons I felt that film was a bit deeper is that, you know, we really have a character who is of lower class, who is a main character in the film, which I thought was a nice touch. Whereas here, they're kind of outside
That's true.
The action, yeah. You know, the main characters the entire time, even when, you know, like Lucy's looking for Mr. Beebe, and of course there's the language barrier, and you know, the driver actually leads Lucy to George.
And a lot of times, I think when Lucy leaves the other actors, and yeah, I forgot about that scene. That again, she did interact with poor people, but I think that's another right. example of her beginning to, I guess, see that there's more to these people than she was led to believe. It's kind of an awakening of sorts.
Yeah, absolutely. Good for her.
Yeah, good for her.
I'm sure. So and it's interesting. I just have to mention the line from Eleanor Lavish, how she talks about how the theory that there's something in the Italian landscape that inclines even the most stolid nature to romance. So it's
right.
You know, you feel that. I mean, you see the violence, but you know, you have that feeling, of course, in this later scene. It really starts with, I think, when Lucy, you know, there's even a bit of a connection, I think, there with the driver, you know, and the way that he's looking at her, where, you know, there is romance, so to speak, in the air.
Sure.
I think,
yeah.
You know, as a writer, Eleanor Lavish kind of hits the nail on the head. So should we talk a bit about gender, you know, this world of women versus the world of men, and how, you know, the two interact, you know, between the characters in the film. So we see, you know, one of the things I noticed, Aaron, and this is probably common, there's various scenes of dressing and undressing in this film. Of course, we see often scenes of the women dressing and how much, you know, clothes they have to wear. And that's juxtaposed with... a scene of men in a pool.
Undressing, so. Yes. Yeah, I wasn't sure if you were going to go there, but yeah.
I didn't know if I should or not, but I thought it was interesting how, you know, the actor Simon Cowell referred to that, how two things were promised, where, you know, nothing shot below the waist, oops,
yep.
And that the pond would be warm, oops again.
Right, so, that was funny. Yeah.
Of course, there are no small actors, only small parts, so to speak. So, of course, I was
good one.
thinking of you know, I have to reference the Seinfeld episode. I was in the pool.
Oh, right. I think there are a lot of stereotypes in this movie, and I think gender is one. But gender is one that really they don't transcend. I don't think. And really, if you think about the time this period is set, the time period in which this is set, they, you know, this is the way gender is, and you really can't break out of that. Women have their roles now. Now they're back. I should backtrack a little from that, because they do say that, you know, of course they say women don't like views, you know,
right.
I don't know about you, but I kind of like a nice view out of a window, especially that.
Oh yeah. Men don't like views. Yeah. I kind of identified that with that though, because, you know, I've always, you know, people say, well, you got to get out and see the world and travel and all that. And I do like to travel, but I feel a bit like Mr. Emerson, you know, just living in George, living that kind of internal world in my head sometimes. So I certainly identified with that, but it is certainly a you know, generalization for sure.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I'm a man, and I travel sometimes. And, you know, if I happen to be in a hotel, you know, I'm not the type that's going to make a big deal out of it, of course. But
right.
If I happen to have a nice view, like the one in Florence, that's, you know, I'm going to appreciate it. And you know, there was one time I was in a hotel, and I woke up, and there was accidentally a very nice view, and I appreciated that. So, But also the, you know, they say that women gossip, and... Mm-hmm. That's one of their vices, and you know, so Charlotte and Eleanor, they do gossip. Of course, we find out why, and I'd say that maybe. Well, I'm trying to think of other females. The other characters, the Allens, they don't really gossip, do they?
No. Well, Not necessarily. I mean, they seem to just point out the virtues of the other characters.
Right.
You know, appreciate them. So yeah.
But you know, I would say that Cecil gossips. You know, he at least he speaks about other characters. Maybe I should say Cecil disparages people.
Right. Yeah.
So
more appropriate.
But yeah, no, I think they're. And then the contrast is, you know, the scene in the field with when they're sitting on the mats, you know, the men are playing around, they're separated, you know, boys right. will be boys, the women are not, they're proper, and of course there's the pool, or the pond, the pool, you put that in my mind. There's the men, and you know, you can't get as roughhouse playing, you know, as that, right. very just few movies.
There was something I noticed in that shot too, and I just, you know, tended to, I read a little bit into it, but that shot where, which is a gorgeous shot, where they're actually walking under the tree towards the lake.
It's right,
a,
right.
It's kind of a long static shot. It made me think of how, you know, they start big in the scene, and men, I think, sometimes tend to think of themselves as big, mm-hmm. but as they walk down to the scene and to the pool, the scenery dwarfs them at the very end.
Yep.
You know, they've walked underneath the tree. So I saw a little bit of you know, maybe commentary there, just in the way that's that shot.
Actually, I caught a screenshot of that, and I put that in the Facebook album, so you can see that there. I did not capture any screenshots of what came after that. But I think it is again a contrast, and then we talk about yeah. Lucy breaking free from these social norms, and you know, of course the this play scene was Mr. Beebe, George, and Freddie, played by Rupert Graves. Freddie yep. was Lucy's brother, and then later she does play with and her little sister, who's really not developed. They play with Freddie. You know, they play this tennis, they play this kind of hybrid badminton tetherball kind of game together. Mm-hmm. So she's not afraid to play. I mean, she wouldn't be playing in the sure. the pond with the guys, of course. But you know, Cecil, right. it's beneath him. And she gets mad at him for that.
Yes.
So it becomes yep. a plot yeah, point as well.
And you can see how the Freddie character, Freddie Honeychurch, tends to identify with and enjoy the company of George much more than Cecil.
Oh, sure.
You know, that's apparent, you know, because he will actually, I mean, Freddie's playful, obviously, and George is also playful, so he, you know, appreciates him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an interesting kind of, well, and he's the one who, when he plays the piano, it's more of a funny song. So,
right, right.
I mean, it's another...
Chopsticks.
Yes, yeah, Chopsticks, thank you. Yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting how it's almost like, you know, Freddie's a combination a bit of both George and Cecil to an extent. I mean, certainly more like mm-hmm. More like George, but, you know, so well, all of
he
these
has the
characters.
He will also come into wealth because of his family lineage, whereas George right. maybe not. George will have to, I mean, I believe, we're really not told much about the Emerson source of income, but I believe that George at some yeah. point will probably have to work. But he, even though he has this privileged position, he's not of the mind, he's not a man of leisure. Well, he is a man of leisure, but, you know, he's not quite as high and mighty. Now, he might become so mm-hmm. as he grows older. He might become a Cecil. I mean... Well, I don't know if anybody's going to become a Cecil. He's so
yeah. Hopefully, they
so
can
grandiose.
Avoid that. Well, and there's a nice shot of one of my favorite shots, and I think part of it's because they linger. And I mentioned the shot where they linger on the tree, and you get a sense more of Cecil really towards the end. I think it's the last time we see him, where you know, he's just, you know, sitting on the stairs.
Right.
And that just gives you just, I think, another insight into, you know, he is uptight and very concerned with, you know, the things that he's into, like literature. But I think you get a little bit of a sense that he's still, you know, he's awkward, but he also is human.
He's lonely. You know? Yeah. And so is
certainly lonely.
So is Charlotte. Yeah. You know, this, the filmmakers are making no secrets about it, that the
Yeah.
You know, it's the Emersons that are correct. It's their worldview is the right one. Whereas and of course this came out during the time of Thatcherism, and there's a lot of political and economic upheaval. I think they're saying that the privilege is the old ways. You know, I almost think of Colonel Blimp, even though this is not a war film. You know, it's really an outdated worldview, and whereas you could even see this is a bit of modernization too. That Lucy and Freddie, George as well, they represent what's to come. So
what's to come? Yeah, yeah. There's certainly a commentary.
A new England. There. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure. So how about the romance? I mean, we've talked about the bludgeoning romance between George and Lucy, and of course the engagement of Cecil and Lucy.
Yeah, MTV's Best Kiss Award does not go to Cecil.
Remove your glasses for Cecil. Come on. that was so wonderfully awkward.
It was a very, very funny scene. And Lewis played it perfectly. Again, over the top, but you have to enjoy it. The other scene, you know, I guess here I'm succumbing to a stereotype, but you know, I'm not the romantic. You know, I'm not going to read a weepy romance film. You know, I'm not going to say I'm, you know, macho, hyper masculine figure as well.
Right.
You know, I'd say the romance, and especially the second kiss between George and Lucy. Oh, it's very moving. Yeah, it's very genuine. And
yeah.
So, what about you?
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I thought the all of the scenes. I just loved George's passion. How he walks right up, and he just goes for it.
Right.
In every chance he gets. So he's quiet. Certainly brooding, like you said, but it's not really a secret that should we get into spoilers at this point, Aaron?
I think we're kind of beyond them. I was referring actually to the final kiss.
Oh, the final kiss. Okay, yeah, because there's the second one in the after the game that he steals.
That's right. I forgot about that one. I was thinking of the final kiss. Yes. Of course, those show the romance, but it's at the end, and actually the end. They're back in Italy. They're away from England, and they're back in the same room actually. So they, maybe she came into her money and she paid for it. Who knows? But
right,
you can tell that they're free finally from these constraints, from these social norms that bother both of them. So
yeah, and it lingers. I love how the shot lingers on them. I mean, a lot of times you get kind of maybe an extended romance scene, kissing scene in a film, but it's the last scene in the film,
right.
And it just takes a little bit of extra time to linger on them, and you can see how how they, I don't want to say complete, but happy they are at that point. And there's just more passion, obviously, in their kiss than there was with Cecil.
And you also see them as a couple. It's not...
Yeah.
And, Hollywood, they just smush the faces together usually. Whereas this is, it's more romantic, but also, you have her reading, trying to read something. It's a little more as a couple, like, the early romantic couple. So, of course, nice to see. We all have, we're all romantics to some degree, I think. Well, except for Cecil.
Right. And I feel like Cecil wants to be, but he's got a ways to go.
He's trapped. And so is Charlotte. Poor Charlotte, poor Cecil, really. That's what the ivory merchant ivory are saying.
Yeah, I would agree. So, should we, anything else to say, Aaron, or should we grade this film?
Yeah, let's get into some grades here. What do you think?
All right, well, I'll go first. I could go as low as an 8, but or, I'm sorry, a 7, but I think this is an 8 film on a scale of 1 to 10. I think overall the acting is excellent. I think they really put together a stellar cast. All across the board. I mean, of course, there are some performances that stand out better than others, but and I know they aren't well paid in Merchant Ivory films, especially, at least this one, which is, did have a lower budget, but you know, and the screenplay certainly is, you know, just great dialogue, memorable dialogue. I found myself noting so many different quotes, and I also feel like, you know, the movie at just under 2 hours, it moves along just as quickly as it should. I mean, it's supposed to be a slower film, period piece, but it moves along just as well as it should. So I gave it an 8. I liked it a lot. How about you?
That's a difficult one. As I mentioned, I've seen this 3 times, and the first time I was, I would say, a little better than mixed on it. I think a lot of the themes that we've touched on, and a lot of the, actually even the comedy, I think escaped me a little bit. Excuse me. And then the second time I liked it more, but the acting, especially the of course some of the acting was terrific, but the two leads really, I think, are, well, you'd say Lucy is definitely the lead, and maybe George. I don't know if you can consider him the male lead, but yeah, I thought they were pretty weak and brought the material down. I still kind of feel that way a little bit. Especially George. Julian Sands, I think, you know, he's done good work. He's done bad work too. But I would say that he didn't quite fit. Some of his lines seemed a little stilted, you know. So yeah, it's tough. I definitely like the movie a lot more. You know, I appreciate, you know, all the technical, you know, the costumes, the photography, everything, the art direction. I think I'm 7.5.
7.5. Yeah. So I think that's very fair. Like I said, I could go 7 to 8. So I could go either way.
Yeah, I do like it. I should say, since Trevor was going to be on the show, he really likes this movie. And in fact, he said he likes the movie more than he likes the book. And he's read the book. You know, that's what he did his master's thesis on. So
yeah,
that, I think that speaks something. So give our views an asterisk. Yeah, somebody that really knew something liked him a lot more.
Yeah, I mean, and one reason I could go even as low as a 7 is I think if you compare these, it's a good entry point, but I think if you compare this to something like Howard's End, is definitely a richer film, and, you know, I haven't seen Remains of the Day, but, feedback, what do you think? Yeah,
I'd say this is a good entry point, and actually because this was a transitional point for their careers, they started getting more budgets.
Right.
Remains of the Day, I don't know the budget offhand, but I'm guessing it's you know, multiples of what this budget was, and you really do see that on the screen. Of course, Anthony Hopkins doesn't hurt as well, but
yeah, that helps.
So in both films. Standpoint.
Yeah. So, and you know, we like to talk about the supplements a little bit there. I wouldn't say there's a lot of supplements, but I did think the supplements were pretty strong. Thought and Passion, that's a documentary that's really more with the filmmakers, James Ivory, the cinematographer Roberts, and the costume designer John Bright. And then there's also The Eternal Yes, that's a documentary with the actors. So Helena Bonham Carter, Simon Callow, Julian Sands, and these are all new. They were produced
Criterion,
you know, recently, 2015.
So. Yeah, it's nice to see them. The Criterion does some of these. There was also a NBC Nightly News. That was a shorter piece, which really was just basically about the Merchant Ivory. And this was from around the time, I think, not too long after A Room with a View had really made it big.
Right. Yeah, I think it was like a pre-Oscar. It was a pre-Oscar piece. So it was like March of 87. And you're right. It talks more about the partnership and the fact of it being their first commercial success with American audiences. So it's, you know, it's gives that American perspective, right? Because it's you know, from the Oscars, and it features Roger Ebert and of course the Siskel.
Oh right.
So yeah, it's just nice to have their. It's nice to see them on screen again.
Yeah, and of course it's great to hear from James Ivory. You know, we don't, obviously he's not on Criterion anymore, except for Howard's End. Right. But you know, him talking about the genesis of the project. You know, from him, Ishmael optioning the book because James liked it, and you know, going to Italy, and I remember one quote I pulled from James Ivory is one guy was told, quote, "The only exciting thing."
Yes.
The only thing exciting is a tea party in a Merchant Ivory film. And you know what? The tea party was pretty good in this film.
Yes, so, it was.
And then the casting.
Good opening.
His first choice for Cecil was Rupert Everett, which I think is interesting. You know, of course, at that time, Daniel Day was not well established. Who knows if they even were able to see Beautiful Laundrette? If they had, they might not have cast him because, you know, this guy played a lower class. Well, you know, this is the opposite end of the spectrum.
Right.
And then he talked about how Hugh Grant was kicked out of his audition after 30 seconds, which was actually true. Mm-hmm. But of course, he would appear later with and he was in Remains of the Day, and you know, he's been well. He was, it was not Merchant Ivory, but Sense and Sensibility is often lumped in with those, and of course that was Grant. So, yeah, interesting background.
Yeah, I like the, you know, kind of the mix of the two also, where, you know, Ivory is talking about how talking about directing, how, you know, he calls directors wide and shallow, whereas the actor is contained but deep, and how they, you know, right. He talked about that relationship and how they, you know, he really liked to let actors be the artists that they are, and you get that really backed up by Callow, who talks about I thought he was the funniest. I'd call him a
he was
hoot,
funny, yes.
I'm not going to use the word hoot, although I just did. But he was the funniest of the interviews. How, you know, he really said, you know, said the same thing, and I believe Carter did too. How you know, there wasn't a lot of direction. Mm-hmm. You know, he let the actors play the part that they would. He would only, you know, interject if he needed to. So that was nice. And one of my favorite quotes too, of course, I laughed out loud again from the pool scene, where he talked about, Simon Callow talked about it being two gazelles pursued by a hippopotamus. So pretty self-deprecating there.
Yeah, but that was but, funny. You know, funny guy. I imagine he'd be a fun guy to have a drink with.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting hearing Carter reflect on her role. You know, of course, now she's a famous actress and Academy nominated. I can't remember if she won offhand. I'll check later. But her talking about being 18 and being, you know, kissing a man, kissing Julian Sands at 18, and actually she said she couldn't stop laughing when she was kissing Daniel Day-Lewis, right. But I mean, who could?
I know. Just funny scenes anyway.
Very funny scene. But I did pick up on a little bit of 18-year-old girl passion at the final scene, so I wonder about that. But she also mentioned that she was actually made to stay in a small room, so she wondered if that was some sort of method they were placing on her.
staying,
You know, interesting supplements. Not abundant, but
right. But good content, you know, for what they are. I think the first one was 20 minutes, and the second 30. And I liked it. I mean, the trailer, it does include a trailer, which was, you know, fine. Didn't really add much to it. But so, I mean, overall, you know, before we give our grading, I did just want to mention, Aaron, about the disc. I mean, I think it's a lovely transfer. It's got, you know, nice grain, nice film grain. I think fans of grain will like it. There is some shimmer at times, but it's a 4K scan from the original camera negative. And there is a note within the booklet I actually noticed late last night about how there was an issue where I think during the processing, I don't know exactly how they do it, but almost like exposing it too soon, you might say. So the chroma hue had to be fixed. So that was interesting from the camera negative. And something I just wanted to mention for folks, if you are going to watch it or rewatch it, there's a note in the booklet that I forgot to check, and this has been there for other Criterion discs. When they have a 2.0 surround soundtrack, it says to be sure to enable the Dolby Pro Logic. So, which I forgot to do. I usually just do it straight, but you know, that is something that Criterion suggests doing. So if you're running it through a receiver, just make sure you turn your Pro Logic on.
Well, oops, I guess I'm watching it a fourth time because I did not do that. Also, yeah. I should correct you. It's not a booklet. It's a fold-out thing. So some people with Criterion, and in fact, I'm one of them. I like the booklets, but
I do too. I like this better than the roadmap style. But it's more of an insert.
But actually, I didn't read it, and the reason I haven't read them is because they're not actual booklets. I will flip through them if they are booklets. So if you're listening, Criterion, give us our booklets.
Well, we want booklets.
They've given a few. So
Well, there was one comment. I think you'd appreciate, Aaron, how the writer John Pym did speak to the sunlight and compared it to the masterworks of Renoir.
Oh, good. Okay.
Or Romare. So
maybe his dad.
So what would you give overall this disc as a Criterion rating, Aaron?
I think a good 8.
Yeah.
I think
that's fair.
I think they could have stuffed it with extras. I kind of wonder if there was another DVD at some point. This might, I'm just speculating, maybe part of the Merchant Ivory troubles, maybe they can't get stuff from early DVDs or early releases. Of course, we always want a commentary. We love commentaries. Yep. Would have loved one for this one.
Oh, yeah, from James Ivory or both, you know, some of the actors. It would have been great. But
would have been wonderful. But, you know, I think 8 is fair.
Yeah, I'm there with you. I mean, again, we mentioned the supplements are pretty solid, and I love the, these types of film, Merchant Ivory films, I'd love to see more on Blu-ray. You know, I think the DVD format is fine, but this needs HD just for the way that the film looks. So you know, I'll give it, I almost want to give it just higher marks because it getting a Merchant Ivory film back into the collection, which, you know, kind of talking a bit about the canon side of it here. But what do you think? Is this canon worthy, Aaron?
To your point, it does look good, by the way. And I'm kind of in between. I like a little grain. I don't want too much.
Yep.
I thought this was the right amount. I would not say it's canon worthy. I'd say again, I'm with you. I'm glad to get some more Merchant Ivory in print, but I don't think you can put this alongside the best films of all time.
Right. So. I would agree, and I'd almost want to put it as a canon because it is getting Merchant Ivory back. But no, it doesn't. You know. Quite belong there. So,
and again, I'll say Trevor would probably vote yes. We'll have to hear from Trevor later. He would probably say yes. Why are you guys not putting this in the canon?
Right.
No, actually, Trevor's a lot nicer than that. He would.
Yeah, he is.
He would respect our opinion, but and probably appreciate that we like it, but maybe not as much as him. So. Right.
Well, that's it. That's A Room with a View. Great talking to you about that, Aaron. And we just wanted to let folks know, of course, we may have some new folks listening from the Criterion Cast Network, where to find us online. So you can find us at it's criterionclosup.com/podcast. You can also find us on Facebook at Facebook/Criterion Closeup. You can find us on at criterioncast.com. This episode will probably be posting a little earlier on the Criterion Close-Up site than Criterion Cast. But
yeah, and we'll work all that out. But if you subscribe, and I recommend you subscribe anyway to the Criterion Cast main feed, this will eventually, I believe this episode will go into the main feed, and then subsequent ones will as well. So,
right.
And they have all sorts of stuff. They have the newsstand. They have Off the Shelf. They have...
Yeah, talking about physical media releases. Yeah,
the titles,
great
right.
Content.
Yeah, good stuff. So we're glad to be in such great company. So you can find us there. And what
yeah,
about...
Where can folks find you online, Aaron?
Well, I was just about to ask you the same question. Funny. I'm on Twitter, AWES505.
Yeah, same here. On Twitter, at Mark Herney. It's H-U-R-N-E. And, you know, folks, we'd love some more iTunes reviews. If there are some new folks out there, let us know what you think. Send us some feedback at, we have an email address, feedback@criterionclosup.com. Comment on Facebook, and we would love the interaction. And next week, as we did preview, we are doing a double feature. Bruce Beresford, a couple of releases, Breaker Morant from 1980 and Mr. Johnson from 1990. And, of course, special guest, Another West.
That's
looking
right.
Forward to that.
Double feature and my wife. So, my wife. I can't do Borat again. All right, well, let's close out with a kiss. Not with you, Mark. Sorry.
Nope.
You're not my type. No offense.
Thank goodness.
But we're going to close with the music playing that was playing during the kiss. So yes. I think that's a good way to end the show.
It is. Yeah, this scene is the eternal yes, if folks are looking for it on the disc. So
yes, Happy New Year, everybody. Thanks again.
Thank you.